in. So I think the last thing that we were doing was is we were trying to, you know, having gone through the issue of, I guess, Misora, as it relates to the end of Ubikashna Misham, and again the connection to Nebuah and Gilui, you know, Shechina, which is like a continuous thing, and it collapses the, you know, the generation gap and so on and so forth, or the gap between generations, maybe a better way to say it. So we went on to discuss the piece in the Igros HaGrid, where he himself establishes was like a long-standing piece, part of which, you know, became, you know, very, very famous, as I say, many, many years later. And in retrospect, to see it was, you know, really just part of the bigger piece. And that is the, to make a triple connection, that's the thing that we're talking about in the end, between, number one, Derech HaLimud. The other is the authority of Chachmei HaMisora, beyond, I guess, the specific evidence that they bring, or maybe the narrow pronouncements, or the pronouncements of what might be considered narrow halacha. I'll explain it in a second, just as part of the review. And then the third, really interestingly enough, the question of the role of Chachmei Misora in representing, I guess, the interests of Klal Yisrael, right, in a bigger way. Those are three seemingly unrelated things, might be unrelated, but putting them together, again, there's a certain gestalt, you know, there's a certain, like, holistic, you know, perspective that that implies. So the first one is, again, Derech HaLimud, the idea that Misora is not just about it. It's not about information, it's not about the accuracy of transmitting information. It's really about, you know, again, a certain there's a certain, like, indefinable, like, component that you know, the personal transmission from Rebbe to Talmud or father to son adds. It's a dimension that goes beyond the material, obviously, to, you know, to the method that the material is transmitted, its importance, I guess. And more importantly, this he doesn't say, but this is implicit in the second part, especially, is that that method of transmission, you know, also conveys a certain, has substantive impact. In other words, it gives you a certain ineffable, maybe, you know, impression of, you know, what the material really is all about. Because you're, I'm speculating, but I think this is what it means. That, you know, the you know, your understanding and your assimilation, I would say, of the material, you're receiving the material, you know, is different when you receive it from someone who has that level of immersion and who has a personal connection with you. Again, that's part of the, these are different pieces. I'm suggesting to read one in light of the other. But the idea of the end of Bikasha Mishama connection or parallel to the Ruah, and how the Navi is transformed by his experience, and then he gives something of that experience and even of himself, you know, to his audience. So that's kind of the idea, if you ask me, although again he didn't connect them, in the first, you know, third of that piece. Namely the idea that, you know, the personal transmission from Rebbe to Talmud is something singular that, you know, goes, transcends you know, the material itself, its accuracy, and so on. There's something about the way the material is transmitted that has impact in terms of the quality of the material and the ability, I guess, to apply it in a different way and to integrate it and for it to be transformative for the recipient and down the road, you know, for the you know, the recipients of the recipient, you know, and so on and so forth. So that's one. I think that's, again, not obvious, but I think it is very compelling. The second is a Makish Magideha, which, as we pointed out, could be read very narrowly as being a sensationally overreaching, you know, kind of a concept. Because again, the idea is that Makish Magideha, the use of that phrase in the Rambam and Hilchos Tshuva, doesn't mean when you argue with them about matters of halacha, it means when you argue about the matters outside of halacha. So what do we mean by that? And again, I'm speculating, but I believe, you know, it's intelligent speculation. And that is that it doesn't for sure mean infallibility, and it doesn't mean, you know, nevuah, you know, or ruach hakodesh, you know, whether you should, you know, intercede or intervene, overstep in areas that require other kinds of expertise. But what it does mean is that in the, you know, the gray areas in between, where you need more than the sum of your knowledge, and where your instinct and your attunement to the totality of the system matters, you know, in those kind of issues, where you could just, you know, basically question the Chacham and say, like, you know, prove that to me, how do you know that, you know, show me where it says that, can't you, you know, you could say it differently. So again, it's always fine to challenge and to ask. Sometimes it, you know, pushing people, you know, inspires them, motivates them to formulate things better, more sharply, for them to reassess and reconsider. But I think the point is, in the end, you know, result, the challenge, or the assumption of the challenge, which is, you're no better than the, you know, information that you have assimilated. You know, you're like a walking, you know, computer or a data bank. You know, that is what is not just offensive, but is heretical. And again, that's the, to me, the idea of walking safety. Again, the Rav doesn't say this, he just says what he says. It's clear to me that it's something, this is how I understand it, it's clear to me that it's something like this. Anyway, certainly that's the way I understand it. Mm-hmm. So that's not infallibility, it's not an overreach at all, it's a global understanding based on deep conviction and attunement to the total system that definitely rests on instinct and intuition, but instinct and intuition that is honed. And that is another way of saying, you know, knowledge or perspective that is more than the sum of the parts of what you've received or studied, but is totally based on it. And again, it comes from the first as well. So I think that's very critical. I mentioned that there's a hesped for Reb Chaim Ozer where he talks about Das Torah. That goes even a little further, but... clearly, this is a very strong statement and a very important one. And I think when we were talking in the end, I was just trying to make the point that even the Rav's own things, for example, in Bikashna Visham, we were trying to show that there are some, you know, like you could say, Mehek and Tesi, about a lot of things that we just read, right? About Chachmei Masorah, the connection to Nevuah, all those kind of things. You know, the experiential motif and Talmud Torah and Kriyas Torah and so on and so forth. They're not, you know, rayot chotchot. They're not, you know, rayas that you came to Hashiv Aleihem. But it's the idea that somebody who spent a lifetime doing this on a very, very high level, a first tier, you know, walking Sefer Torah like that, that he has insights and that those insights are invaluable and that they are part of the system. Doesn't mean another Chacham can't argue with them, and it doesn't mean that even a hedgehog can't ask about them. But that's, again, in the material that we're doing. It's just very obvious and very clear, and that is a critical critical idea.
Is there you talking even, let's say, just learning of a sugya, let's say?
What's that?
Like learning a sugya, let's say, like the Ramban's Mofis Choteich. Would that also be Nechal, what Rabbi's talking about? How just, like, some people just have, like, a feeling towards a sugya? Or can, because
I think so. I think it expresses itself in all sorts of different ways. The Ramban does write. The Ramban points out that you know, sometimes there is no 100% raya.
So in the halachic realm, we wouldn't just say mechit. I feel like in the halachic realm, we need more of a...
Well, I mean, I think you do, but again, even their instinct plays its role. Put it this way, the relationship to, like, hashkafic issues, let's say, as opposed to halachic issues, is, in my opinion, like a double-edged. It's a complicated question. You know, on the one hand, people who have halachic training, you know, mostly gain their instinct and their intuition from halachic sources. So you would think that, you know, sticking to that, you know, derech hachashiva, that way of thinking and that way of applying, you know, is going to make for more effective, you know, application of that special talent or insight that people have. On the other hand, it's dafka in the area where there are, let's say it's contradictory evidence, or there's no, you know, ideal answer, something has to go, you have to make sacrifices, halachic sacrifices. In other words, you know, you have to be mamayit, you know, bara, or marba betov, as the case may be, because you're dealing with a situation where, unfortunately, you know, you don't have an ideal answer, something needs to be sacrificed, or just a pure area in between where you don't have enough halachic evidence, or, you know, where there are hashkafic, you know, issues that, you know, overlap other things that are complex. You know, it's there where you kind of need these leap of faiths or this attunement, this diagnostical, you know, instinctive ability more. But it's still more amorphous. That's what I would say. I think both those things. Again, if you take the Rav stuff on, some things that he's very well known for, from a policy point of view, let's say the mechitzos, things that he wrote, or the, you know, guidelines for interfaith dialogue, Synagogue Council of America for dialogue with, you know, other Jewish denominations. If you read the stuff and you're not a fan or you're not a believer, I don't mean, you know, in a crude way, meaning if you want to make a taste of it out, you could. You could say, oh, where does it say that in the Shulchan Aruch? Where does it say that in the small print? You know, and ironically, the more learned you are, the more appreciative you are, that here's somebody who's able to, you know, to articulate policy, you know, in a situation where there just aren't so many sources. You know, but what he's just so suffused with, you know, with Torah knowledge and hashkafa, that, you know, this is a very compelling case. And you need people like that more when there's less evidence or when there's harder to, you know, manage evidence, etc. So I think it is true in a sugya. You know, again, the Rav writes in Ish Halacha, as another example, that, I think I mentioned this already for a different reason, that Vasuke Shmaitza Libe de Hilchasa, doesn't have to have a narrow meaning. But usually it's meant that, you know, you learn in order to figure out what the halacha is and to implement it properly, so you'll know how to behave and you can rack up your, you know, what's a kach baruch hu lezakus as yisrael lebikachir balem torah mitzvos, you know, and you can, win the prize of olam haba, you know. So, you know, that minefield of olam haza won't, you know, actually, you know, prevent you from the ultimate prize by drawing on things that we discussed last week. And that's how many people understand Lav Suke Shmaitza, Ali B'Hilchasa. The Rav is arguing in the Ish Halacha that that's maybe not what it means, has a broader meaning. What it means is to figure out, you know, to go through the sugya, and to figure out, like, what's the dominant view of the sugya. Right? And it doesn't matter whether it's been Sora or Mora, Yoron Nidachas, you know, which according to several views of Chazal, Lahoya Velo Nivra, Drosh V'Kabel Schar, because you need to know La Suke Shmaitza Ali Ben Hilchasa on that too. So there are two things. Number one, of course, that reflects his view that, you know, the system of halakha is a value system, and it's a system of ideas and concepts, and therefore whether you can realize them in the real world is of secondary importance. Right? It doesn't matter that Lahoya Velo Drosh V'Kabel Schar doesn't mean, you know, get more credits. It means, like, you've engaged this topic. They're just as real, even if you can't implement them, because they say something about, you know, rebelliousness and kibud av v'em and avodah zarah. So they build the concepts which are very real for us. But the other part is, like, how do you, what does that mean, Lasuke Shmaitza Libet Elkosa, if it's not Lamaisa? You know, so what, you know, what it means is that you develop a chush, you know, exactly what we're talking about. You know, maybe you don't have, like, a raya, you know, a machras, or chotachas, that can, you know, show you that this, sometimes you do, but sometimes you don't. So, like, how do you know whether, you know, primarily we go with the approach of the Ramban, or the Raibin, or the Rambam, or the Rajba? There's a lot of intuition involved, you know, in making that decision, and it's fine that there is. So I do think it means that. I just think it also means much more. So that's kind of. And then the third part, as we said, was the representation of Klal Yisrael, which you really could have thought was a completely different idea, because you know, that's just, you know, standing in for Moshe Rabbeinu, you know, who was the Melech. You know, sometimes you need Sanhedrin, sometimes you need the Melech. You know, sometimes Chachmei Yisrael, you know, serve that function. But the idea that these are connected, namely, that it's because the Derech of Mesorah and Makish Magideha, you know, redefine and elevate what Chachmei and Mesorah are. Therefore, the Chachmei and Mesorah are these kind of natural ambassadors, you know, for the entire interests of the Jewish people in certain areas. That too is a very fascinating idea. Okay, so that's really what we did. Again, I would recommend Chaim Ozer, Espin is further, and other passages. But we want to get back to Bikash to Bishon, right? So that will be Kori Lamafrei, as we said. So we're going to start from the beginning. So let me just say something about Shir HaShirim. Because the Bikash to Mishon is really centered on Shir HaShirim. It's just a very interesting thing, number one, that the Rav is very drawn to Shir HaShirim. Again, you know, everybody's drawn to Shir HaShirim, I guess. It's one of the, you know, Sifrei HaKodesh. It's in the canon, one of the 24 Sfarim. So, you know, everybody should be drawn to it, I guess. On the other hand, of all the Sfarim, it's, you know, one of the most difficult. If you just read Shir HaShirim, it's very difficult. Right? Very, very difficult. Mishlei is hard to read. Shir HaShirim is hard to read for similar reasons. It's written in a style that is, you know, allegorical and poetic, and, you know, sometimes you need a you know, a scorecard, you know, to figure out who's saying it to who. Right? Just look at the Perushim on Shir HaShirim. Right? Number one, what is this an allegory of? You know, it seems very intense, you know, at moments. You know, for to be, you know, a Sifrei Kodesh, which is why there was so much controversy about whether to let whether to let Shir HaShirim into the canon or not, because, you know, it was a little bit too intense, we'll say, you know, for some, at least that was, you know, a perspective. You know, we end up saying that Shir HaShirim is Kodesh Kodashim, and it's the Shir HaShirim. So, you know, we go from going, you know, we'll keep it out, or, you know, it's not appropriate, you know, to it being like, you know, Shir HaShirim, you know, Kodesh Kodashim. Despite the fact that the, you know, allusions are about romantic love, which is a very intense topic, and even though the, you know, obviously the, you know, the Nimshal is the Rabbeinu Sholem, and we're very usually very, very careful how we refer to him. But of course, it's not even though, it's dafka because, right? It's even though and dafka because at the same time, is what I'm trying to say. Meaning, what's unique about Shir HaShirim, it's very hard to read, you need a scorecard, you need to, you know, translate what the references are, both in pshat and in, you know, the allegory itself. There's a debate a little bit what the allegory exactly is, although everybody agrees, you know, that it's about the Rabbeinu Shalom and Klal Yisrael in some way or another. But in the end of the day, it's this combination, or what the Rav would call a dialectic, of being about a topic which is extremely, which provokes great reticence on the one hand, maybe even philosophically seemingly impossible or unbridgeable, which I'll get to in a second, and at the same time, you know, being very necessary. You know, it's about, you know, the chavaya, if you will, the experience of Avas Hashem, and of feeling, you know, the connection which gives our lives meaning, purpose, basically. So the ability to talk about this, you know, intensely through a mashal nimshal and through, you know, ambiguity, you know, and through a mechanism of a shir, right, is what makes Shir HaShirim so remarkable. So the Rav, it's interesting, was particularly drawn to Shir HaShirim. I think it makes total sense. This is, again, me talking, he didn't say any of this. But a number of his, like, famous essays revolve around Shir HaShirim. Just very curious or not curious. The Hespit for available was Madhvanet Bidot. Did you get a chance to read it yet?
On my list, though.
I'm not trying to put you on the spot. So, Madhvanet Bidot is the Hespit for available, which is a very critical piece in the Rav's thinking. I'll also add that in that piece, right, the sod of that piece, I think we've mentioned it already, was an analysis, part of it is analysis of Erusin and Nisuin, right, and the contention, you know, it's a Hespit, that, you know, that his father, his grandfather, his uncle, which is really a Hespit for the uncle, you know, didn't just have an Erusin relationship with the Rabboni Shel Olam, but a Nisuin relationship. So that's a great, you know, that's a great theme, you know, for a Hespit, which is headlined. I don't think it was originally headlined this way, but when he published it, he changed the headline to Mato Dech Midod and Shir HaShirin, right? Because the whole point is, you know, how do you convey, you know, a greater sense, not a formal attachment and compliance and loyalty or contractual loyalty, which is what Erusin is. How do you convey a Nisuin relationship, meaning a more intimate, no barriers, you know, or few barriers relationship, you know, kind of a Dover de Mimela, the Lumbus part. I don't want to go into the whole Erusin Nisuin thing for the moment, but assuming you understand the basic illusions, like how do you, you know, convey that? And the answer is, you know, Madodech Midot. That's kind of what Shir HaShirim is about. So it's very interesting that. And then, of course, Kol Dodi Dofei, which is also like a major essay that they wrote. Again, he didn't publish much. You know, and again, in the end, things started, you know, he started letting things come out. But things that he did publish and put out, Bikash Misham, much later than he wrote it, but Bikash Misham, which is about Abbas Hashem and Yeras Hashem. You'll see the dialectic in the beginning already. Madodech Midod, which is this Hespit for Avelvel, and which he released, and Kol Dodi Dofeik was the, you know, the piece on the Shoah, and, you know, Kuma Medina, you know, Eretz Yisrael, and, you know, and the idea of knocking on the door, you know, and lost opportunities or opportunities that were squandered, you know, not to squander future opportunities. So it's just very interesting to me. It's my comment. Could be other people have made it too. I don't know. But so much is, you know, ensconced in Shir HaShirim. But I think that, you know, I think Koheles really spoke to the Rav a lot, and I think Shir HaShirim really spoke to him a lot. You know, the same reason I guess it really spoke to David HaMelech, you know, or Shlomo HaMelech, and that is that it's, you know, it's again, it's a way of speaking appropriately, you know, but intensely about a davar shebikdusha, you know, which needs to be conveyed as an experience, you know, but without tarnishing it or trivializing it or making it crude or making it pedestrian, is basically what I'm trying to say. So the way to do that, like, what better way? That is the challenge of Shir HaShirim, and that is what's Kodesh Kadoshim about it. So I don't think that is a coincidence. In addition to which, of course, is the fact that, you know, the theme itself, which is about this, you know, constant oscillation, you know, between, you know, seeking and withdrawing, you know, winning and losing voluntarily, you know, self-defeat, this whole, you know, march and retreat is how the Rav understands, you know, the relationship between man and the Rabboni Shel Olam by definition, right? And as also embodied by, you know, the dialectic of Avas Hashem and Yiras Hashem. So it's perfect. I'm just pointing out that it also seems to be the perfect way of conveying other, you know, very deeply, profoundly felt experiential things in his worldview. And I think that is understandable. The Rav once said about Shir HaShirim, not here, that that the reason that it's Kodesh HaKadoshim, Kol HaShirim Kodesh, Shir HaShirim is Kodesh Kadoshim, is because it is so obscured. In other words, it's you know, it's so ambiguous. The ambiguity is a kind of tsnius, and you know, tsnius is correlated by to kedusha, right? Kedushin tiyu is prushim and arayos. So the more, but the trick is, and this is what I'm trying to say really, is that you know anybody can be tsanua. I should say it's hard to be tsanua, especially in our time. But meaning to be tsanua, but to lose the you know the ability to transmit or to convey the experience, you know, is one thing. And if you have to make that hard call, then maybe that's what you're supposed to do. But to be able to, you know, convey it and still be tsanua, you know, that's the trick. That's the apex of, you know, the capacity of man. Maybe it's a capacity of ruach memalala, you know, of man's capacity of articulation. But this, of course, is ruach hakodesh. And so to use words that are concrete, and to use intense words, and to use them in a manner that defines and doesn't trivialize the most, you know, intimate and distant and difficult and impossible and necessary relationship of all, right? That's requires tznius, but it also requires, you know, the power of articulation. So I think it's the Rav said the piece about tznius. I'm adding the part about the articulation. In that sense, it's Kodesh HaKadoshim. I think that a shir in general has this special quality about it that it is, like other things we were just talking about, more than the sum of its parts. Right? I mean, I'm not, an avid fan of poetry, to be honest with you. I find most poetry at least leaves me a little bit unmoved, but I'm not talking about Shira Shira, right? the greatness of poetry, from what I hear, or the feat in Shira Shira, what we experience, is this ability, again, to take words and to express something that is more than the sum of the content or the substance of what they're saying, right? To pique your feelings and your imagination. You know, to almost to make the ineffable articulate. That's a very remarkable capacity, and there, you know, this is done in a Ruach HaKodesh way. You know, so it has. So I think that has to be the only way that we're able to connect, you know, to feelings, intense feelings, and then attempt to identify what it is to have a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the dialectical part, and the ineffability. Yet articulation at the same time. It's almost like, you know, you megala tefach mechasa tvachayim. You know, people point out that some shirim anyway, like ariach al gabe levena, you know, there's like twice as much, you know, blanks as text. And there's something to that, because the ambiguity and the inability to, you know, to reduce it to what you're saying, but again, to touch curiosity and so on, all of that is what you want to accomplish. Again, I don't think it's a coincidence, this is maybe for another time, I want to get to the beginning here for a second, that Torah itself is a shira, right? The mitzvah of Ksiva Sefer Torah, you know, in the end of the Torah, in Devarim, is, you know, Kisvu Lachem Es HaShira Hazos. And the Rambam in particular has a very fascinating, well-known formulation of this in Perek Zayin Hilchos Sefer Torah Halacha Aleph, where he basically says that you know, the Torah says Vato Kisvu Lachem Es HaShira Hazos. There's a huge debate in the Mefarshim. You know, do we mean that? Do we mean the Shira, meaning Azinu, or do we mean the Torah? But in the end of the day, that's the Makar. So the Rambam kind of bridges the gap by saying, you know, ain't kosvin, you know, parshios parshios, right? You can't write just the parsha of the Shira. So the Torah says, kisvu lachem es HaShira Hazos, it means the Shira. But by extension, when you're writing the Shira, you have to write the whole Sefer Torah. Right. So I think that there could be like a very narrow technical way to understand that, meaning, you know, you really have to write, you know, two opposite ways, I guess. You have to write the Sefer Torah, but the Torah has signified it in this way. The way that they were megala that you have to write the entire Sefer Torah is by telling you have to write the Shir. Okay? That's one way to look at it. And of course the question is, like, you know, why not just say have to write Torah? Right? Why say it in such an oblique fashion? Or the other way, really, 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 we'd like you, the mitzvah would be to write the Shira. That's fascinating. You know, but you can't do it, so you have to write the Sefer Torah. Then the significance of the Sefer Torah is, like, you know, it's a Sefer Shiyesh Bo HaShira. You know, the chalos of containing the Shira is why we write a Sefer Torah. Maybe it is, it's more than that. That's part of what defines a Sefer Torah. But I prefer to say, rather than either technical extreme, where the second one wasn't so technical, is that the Torah is basically telling us, you have to write a Sefer Torah by telling us you have to write a Shira, because what they're saying is that the Shira is emblematic of the way that you're supposed to. Number one, Torah is a davar sheyesh ba Shira. And number two, there's something about the Shira, right, and this particular Shira, you know, that is symptomatic, you know, of the way that we should be relating to the whole Torah, right? And I think it's exactly this way, meaning the Torah is written in so many different layers. You know, the ambiguities are there not to confound you, but, you know, to enrich, you know, to, I guess, expose you to the different layers, you know, and to inspire you, basically. They're very meduyak. They're much, much, much more meduyak than you ever could have dreamed when you get to the, you know, to the deep bottom of them. Moreover, the Torah is also intended to be an experience. It's supposed to, Kishem Hashem Ekra HaVogodol Elokeinu, it's supposed to be about Shemos Hashem, and it's supposed to be a Shira, in the sense that it is, you know, language that is crafted, you know, in a very special way to convey more than the words, you know, themselves. You know, Yosef Bimash Kosev Khan. And of course, Torah Shabbat Peb, you know, demonstrates that, you know, completely. You can't read Torah Shabbat Tzav without a Peirush. That's a symptom of a Shira. But it's also the experiential, I guess, connotation of it as well. And the, again, both ineffability, but accessibility at the same time, and the more than the sum of the parts of it. So the Torah is defined as Davar Sheyesh Bo Shira, or Shira is Torah, Torah is Shira. And that is true for Hazinu especially. But it's also true when we talk about Shir HaShirim, the ultimate Shira, because, again, since it's tackling this, you know, very intense, you know, seemingly impossible but totally necessary a task, namely to describe the religious experience and to inspire people, even as philosophically this is something that is not, you know, accessible to us, because the Rambam's obstacles are just an example, like, you know, negative theology and negative attributes and all the other things. So in the end of the day, Shir and Shir HaShirim in particular becomes like just a very compelling method or methodology of speaking about profound, you know, emotional, but in an objective way, religious experiences. That, I think, is an important, that's not the rub, but that's, I think, an important perspective as we move forward. So let's start at the beginning. I'm going to stop in a couple minutes and then we'll keep going forward as we continue with this. So the very beginning of Bikashna Misham already just invokes the first chapter. Anybody, guys, read it? English, Hebrew?
English.
We can do the Hebrew.
What?
You said the Hebrew saying.
I think I marked them first also. So, you did a good job. Who did this, Lawrence Kaplan?
I think it was Schatz.
But David Schatz.
Okay. There's two people.
Oh, two people did this?
Okay.
David has better words. Wait, you're related to David Chen.
Yeah, so as much.
We're both
related.
Great uncle. Oh, so the good thing I said. No, I really mean that. Okay. Used to be related to Lawrence Kaplan.
Yeah, I used to be. Yeah.
So, wait, so how are you related to David Chen?
My grandmother's brother.
That's your grandmother's brother?
Yeah, I'm related to him through marriage only. My great aunt married.
So right. Through the burgers.
Yeah.
Wait, so how's
grandmother? My grandmother's a Schatz.
Oh, okay. Anyways, he's he doesn't need
incredible.
My
style. Incredible.
I'm a fan. he knows I'm a fan. So he did a very good job. So I was looking at it. So we could do this. Anyway, so the first chapter, I guess, really just sets the tone in a way of the dialectic, which is in Shir HaShirim itself. But because Shir HaShirim is so obscure in some ways, right? It's very easy, to lose just even the major, you need a scorecard sometimes to tell you who's speaking now, who are they talking to, But this, with the Rav kind of, in a very, he kind of condenses a lot of the highlights, let's call it, the bullets of the exchange, and captures, the dialectic of, again, pursuit and retreat, and the ambivalence, but the inability again to actually realize, let's say, the affection, of the two parties involved, and how torturous it is, and how it's a constant oscillation. When one party's ready, the other is not. There's this intense, attraction, which is never consummated. What's fascinating is that he, from the very beginning, connects it up, because the minhag is in many places to say Shir HaShirim and Erev Shabbos. So it's fascinating that he starts the whole discussion as the setting sun of the Sabbath Eve, right? Shemesh Ben Rabbayim Shalim HaShishi. What will do the English?
Did the Rav have that practice?
What?
Did the Rav
I have no
that?
Idea. I have no idea. I'm guessing. It doesn't really matter.
Meaning,
if he didn't, that's what he's referring to.
Right.
So, if he was sitting there, saying Shir HaShirim or reading Tefillah Zakah, but I think it's fascinating because I think this is, again, this is my, I'm darshaning this up a little bit, I'm giving you my take on all of this, for better or for worse, but I think by starting this way, directly or subconsciously, trying to associate the dialectic of religious experience, with the Ribbono Shel Olam and everything that implies, with the no man's land, the Ben HaShmashos in a way, it's a transition from Chol to Shabbos, Ben HaShmashos. And the implication is that when you have a transition from Chol to Kodesh, basically in some respect, you're experiencing the same, march, retreat, and so on. And I think that's a very important idea. In other words, the transition requires that you master this dialectic, because you're getting into a more... Of course, it's also much more specific. It's a Shabbos, Shabbos Malka, and the embrace of the Shabbos Malka, which he says very explicitly, going forward. But this idea of, the strains, the songs... The Song of Songs course into a world becoming pure, and what does it say? What's that next word?
Sanctified.
What?
Sanctified.
Sanctified? Yeah, mine got cut off. Yours aren't cut off?
Yeah, it is.
No.
You gave me the one that's cut off?
Absolutely not cut off.
Wrapped in the serenity of calmness and rest. So, I mean, again, this idea is, you know, kind of like, you know, Shirashirim, you know, is perfect for this time, this transition time, you know, in which you kind of ratchet up one or two notches, you know, the intensity of your Kedusha, you know, and it's a more intimate moment with the Ravon Shalom, which is, again, a big theme in the Ravon's writings of, you know, Yontif being Lifnei Hashem, and Shabbos being a time when you invite the Ravon Shalom into your home. You go to him, he comes to you. But either way, Shabbos and Yom Tov are, as you know, as Moadim, are times, you know, when the intensity of the relationship is upgraded, and you know, not just the intensity, but the intimacy of it, you know, is expressed. So I think that's why, not just because of the minhag, not just because of the mashal, the nimshal of, you know, of Shabbos. But that, you know, this whole idea of transition from Chol to Kodesh, and this idea of Ben Hashmashos in particular, you know, as a necessary mavar, transition, you know, from one to the other, you know, that's all part of this this perspective. And then you have this, you know, very beautifully written, but, you know, a drawing on the language of Shir Shirim itself, of the you know, of the oscillation between, you know, him and her, and the inability of either of them, you know, to ultimately consummate again this relationship. We got to run in a minute, so we don't have to go into that. But I do think what's fascinating is at one point when he discusses, you know, it's the impression that you get is that the you know, the male figure, which of course is the Ravon Shalom, you know, his distance is, you know, more is torturous, but it's more calculated. Like, you know, he's made tzitz min acharakim, you know, because that's the Ravon Shalom, right? He's not again, whatever it means to say that he has these longings and this passion, you know, and this you know, tremendous intense feeling for Klal Yisrael, or for the creation, we'll see in a moment. But in the end of the day, you know, it's more, it can't be a result of any kind of inadequacy. You know, it's a function, again, it's a calculation that is based on the nature or the inadequacies of man or the nature of the relationship. Whereas when it comes to the, when it comes to her, it's nevertheless the beloved, I think it comes from Psukim a little bit, but he expands on it. And again, I don't know how conscious or not. Nevertheless, the beloved refused to rise from her bed and open the door to her lover. The cold of the moonless, starless night, deep weariness, laziness, and fear combined to paralyze her will and to bind her legs. So, she responds, or later on, I have taken off my robe, am I to don it again? You know. Echa Tanfena, right? Am I to still? She responds in lunatic, like, indifference. Now, you don't get the same, and I think the implication is that, again, that this whole dance, if you will, you know, between the two of them, you know, this, you know, march and retreat, this, you know, and so on, is not equal. It can't be. Because in one sense, it's coming from the Ravon Shalom, and the other kind is coming from man, who is inherently flawed, you know, and limited. So maybe Ravon Shalom's reticence, you know, is part of the process, which we're going to see, I think, is really how the Rav develops it later on, although he doesn't go back to this point or make these diukim. But it's a calculated, although I don't mean calculated in an emotionless way. I mean, despite the raging emotions, like, this is a necessary, calculated response to heighten the consciousness of, and to allow the processes to unfold that will bring, you know, the other party, you know, the capacity, you know, to really enter into this relationship. I think that's a key element in the whole Ubikashna Misha. And, all right. So, then towards the end of chapter one, you know, he's basically asks, like, what sort of game is this? You know, what's the character of it? A lover who yearns, who hides, a bride who conceals herself, what does it mean? Right? Everybody, and then again, he gets back to the Shabbos point. As the last rays of the sun set in the dimness of the twilight between the profane weekday and sacred Shabbos approaches, again, I don't know whether he meant it or it's subconscious or I'm reading too much into it, but either way, I believe it's true. Both the reader of Song of Songs and the listener are confused. This mischievous game of enamoredness and rejection, of running after and running away, of tension and disappointment, of searching and hiding, of disclosure and concealment, what does it mean? Right. So again, this is all, you know, even as you're, you know, entering into Shabbos and you're passing through Ben Hashemachos. Steeping themselves in this paradoxical love, right, those who observe Shabbos and call it a delight, which, you know, you need the Hebrew for that, Shomer Shabbos v'korei oneg, right, very poetic, right, invite the lover to go out and greet his bride, the Sabbath queen, and invite the beloved to answer her lover's knock. This is the Shabbos part. You know, again, you can understand that more technically, or, again, to take full advantage of Shabbos, a person has to come to grips, you know, with what it means to live in a whole world and to bring Kedusha to it, you know, and what steps are necessary, you know, in that process. The halacha asserts, which we'll already laid again, all scriptures are holy, but the Song of Songs is holy of holies, right? The song is the most wonderful, most astonishing poem of divine ontic dialectics, right? That's a very interesting, very apt description. Ontic means, you know, the... Anybody here is a philosophy major? No. So, ontic means like objective existence. So this is like the dialectic, this is the, you know, the clash of these, of which flows from the nature of the trying to have a relationship with the Rabbeinu Shalom requires of one, you know, that there's not going to be a straight line, and you're not going to have, you know, just easy access, but that you're going to have to, you know, go through these, you know, tremendous up and downs, you know, cycles, these, you know, these manic, you know, kind of experiences. It's the poem of creation and the creator in general, also interesting, and of the Jewish nation and its God in particular. We'll talk next week just very briefly about the Rambam and Perek Yud Hilchos Tshuva, right, who sees it as an intense connection between the Rabbeinu Shalom and Klal Yisrael, not others say all of creation. And here too, it's an interesting line. The lover creator loves his beloved in creation. The eternal has captivated the spirit of every living thing. Creator has promised the creation he will never abandon her. Finitude has drawn the heart of infinitude with one coil of her necklace. So again, that is a very important line because that's the point. Meaning, and that goes to the point I was trying to make before about how the imbalance between, you know, the Rabbeinu Shalom part and the Klal Yisrael part. Klal Yisrael part, you know, there's also inadequacy and laziness and confusion. And Rabbeinu Shalom's just getting waiting in the wings, you know. Also feeling the intense emotions, but it's not a result of any... Because that the whole point here is that this is a formula, you know, to achieve the necessary, my words now, but also the impossible. Namely, finitude has drawn the heart of infinitude. That shouldn't be possible philosophically. But that's what any religion, you know, the phenomenology of religions is that can happen. Right? And Yadus, you know, which is what we care about, believes that happens through the will of the Rabbeinu Shalom. We call it Kol HaTzimtzum or Ratzon Kadosh Baruch Hu L'Zakos Es Yisrael. That impossible but necessary for meaning reality, you know, is great. So this whole Shir HaShirim basically is the methodology, the necessary torturous step, not for the sake of torture, but to develop, I guess, the mechanisms that make finitudes, you know, love of infinitude and having a relationship possible. That's kind of the... Okay, stop here. Again, I've got to...
Hi, for your sakes too, you have the example.
No, we're not.